Hi guys, and welcome to Tennis Magazine's podcast with me, Linus Eriksson. Today you're going to listen to Dave Bandelin, the founder of the concept Euro Elite. Dave is well known both in Sweden, but in the whole world after traveling on the Junior World Tour for many years. Dave is born in the United States and was the head coach at Cherry Hill Tennis in New Jersey, Wildwood Tennis Club in Indiana, and then coached college tennis for 8 years before moving to Sweden. In this episode, Dave tells us the story how he came from California to Sweden, how he started out, developed and saw Euro Elite grow to what it is today. But mostly he shares all his experience and knowledge about junior tennis. What have he seen the best players in the world doing? What do Scandinavian players need to improve? The values he always tries to teach the kids. Is it worth traveling far for easier ranking points? How have the coaching styles changed over the last 20 years? How have Dave modified his philosophy since he started out? Have money been an unmotivating factor for him? And also, how important do Dave think Euro Elite and himself have been for Swedish tennis over the last 20 years? A great listen for everyone involved in Swedish and Scandinavian tennis, but also for everyone that is interested in player development overall. Now, time to welcome Mr. Dave Bandelin. Okay, I'm sitting here with Dave Bandelin. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Dave, can you start with telling us about your background? You're obviously not from Sweden from the start, but how could you end up here?
I'm from California, born and raised. My dad is Swedish, but we didn't really do Swedish in the house. But that's the background, basically the kind of the Swedish part.
Yeah.
Got to Sweden, very interesting way, is back in the old days in the 80s, Mikael Pernfors, who is from Höllviken, was playing for Georgia.
Okay.
And there's a lot of Swedish players that played for me. I was coaching college at the time at Bethany College, and then later on at University of Texas, El Paso. And they used Mikael Pernfors as a reference for their playing abilities.
Yeah. Okay.
So then I followed up. So I called Michael, and when he was at Georgia, and I'd write him, and we would go back and forth about a couple of players, and that would determine whether I was going to give them a scholarship or not, or invite them to play for my team. And things just kind of grew, we had a guy named Magnus Oscarsson from Malmö, and he actually said, "We're looking to do an exchange with somebody." And Mikael Pernfors is from Höllviken, and I know Mikael, and you know, maybe we can do Höllviken and do an exchange every year. And so I said, "Well, that sounds like something could be fun."
But why? Höllviken is like a very small place, like in a small country in the north of the world.
True. All true. But it back in the day, it was also a tennis mecca.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
You know, you had Pernfors there. You had Anders Monsen. You had Jonas Wallgaard. You have Katarina Lindqvist.
Yeah.
All of those were Höllviken products. Fredrik Rosenqvist also. So they had this team, I think Team Siab, going. And Hasse Fredborg was part of that. So, yeah, it was a really cool opportunity to go to kind of like a small area that was developing such incredible talent.
Yeah, yeah.
And, of course, that comes from coaching, the quality of the coach, the quality of the club that allows that to happen. Mm. So, my first visit was actually after Pernfors was in the finals of French Open. I think he lost to Lendl.
Okay, I don't know.
Back, I think it was 84. And from 84 to 94, we did a 10-year exchange back and forth. 1 year we would be in Höllviken. The next year they would come to the United States.
Okay.
With different leaders back and forth. So, in the 10th year, I liked it so much I stayed.
Oh, wow. And you said like all these great players back in that days were coming from quality coaching and quality that the clubs allowed them, the coaches, to do their work and stuff.
Yeah.
Could you see that when you came to Sweden, those on that exchange, that was the reality, that, wow, the coaches here are good, or the clubs is working so well? Or
if I wouldn't have seen that, I wouldn't have come here.
Okay.
I think one of the things that attracted me the most was the very simple way of living and very simple way of teaching.
Yeah.
When I got my first house here, I rented it with a handshake.
Yeah. That could never happen.
Never
in the
happened
States.
In the States. I rented it with a handshake. Do you promise to pay at the beginning of the month? Sorry about that. It's probably not politically correct to do that. And I said, yes. And we shook hands, and that was it. Yeah. That was it. In America, I would have had credit listening and 10 papers to sign and rent. I would say, would you like a cleaning deposit or a last month's rent deposit? Oh, no, it's okay. Keep it clean. So I fell in love with the place. It was nice. So I know Holbæk is a little special.
And since then, you have had Sweden like your base.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's 25 years now.
25 years.
25 years this year.
And you never miss America?
Never.
No.
No, miss Taco Bell.
Yeah. Of course.
I used to miss American football, but not anymore.
Okay.
I'm past that. But no, not at all. I don't have any big feelings towards that. I travel a lot, as you know, probably on the tour 5 months a year average.
Yeah.
Then I'm doing camps here, less now that I'm older. A lot more when I was younger, when you were also with your elite. And then the summer camps I don't do anymore as well. That goes to Thomas Wall. Then I spent 3 months in Mexico. So at my place there in the winter.
So you get the sun as well.
I need Acapulco. Yeah, I need the sun.
We will obviously talk more about the EuroLeague. But first, like you talked a little bit about it or touched it, that the Swedes and Americans have sometimes different mindset or different ways of living. Mm-hmm. How have you like coped with that since you came to Sweden?
Well, when I chose to come here and I felt that this was a more simple lifestyle, a lot of that had to do with what was happening back in the 80s. Some of my students were starting to really experiment with pot. They think that was better than alcohol. For example, I'm a little bit old fashioned in those kinds of things. I don't like that. So that stuff hadn't come here at that time.
Okay.
I went to the Malmö Festival, visited there back in 84, 85, and hard, just a whole great group of people having a fun time. So yeah, it was a little bit, again, it felt like a simpler life. America was more, you're living to work rather than working so that you can live. And so that was the difference that I really enjoyed. I like working hard, always have. But I think the Swedes found a better way.
Okay.
That they were working, but then they worked so they could have a great vacation and be with their kids, where Americans just kind of work to work.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And that's a generalization. And of course, I'm a little bit of a type A personality anyway. I enjoy working.
Yeah.
but I liked that difference, that very simple difference, just a couple of words.
Okay.
Living to work or working to live.
I understand.
Yeah. So that was the part that caught me the most, that I felt really comfortable here.
Okay. Yeah. Have you felt any, negative sides, like, oh, these things I miss in the American way of living or thinking?
Yeah, I mean, look, you have different Scandinavian mindsets. You have the Danes, you have the Swedes, and you have the Norwegians. We'll put Finland in another category, but we'll just deal with these three because that's who really comes to EuroLeague and that I've dealt with the most. Where the Danes tend to be a little bit more direct, they'll let you know pretty face to face what's going on. The Norwegians will kind of do that as well. The Swedes are a little bit more passive aggressive.
Okay.
They're very good at it. they won't always tell you directly what's wrong, but they'll let you know in their own way.
Okay.
It could be either silence, passing you and not saying hello anymore, or it could be looking at their watch. But instead, an American would say, "Hey, I want to go. I got to go.
Yeah.
You know, I'm tired. I'm going to go home now." Well, okay. You know, Swedes are a little bit more refined, I think, at giving those hints.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So it was really interesting. A little frustrating sometimes.
I would, yes.
Yeah, but I've gotten used to it over the years, and you have to accept where you're living. I mean, at the end of the day, I chose to live here.
Yeah, yeah,
so,
of course.
So this is the how things go.
Yeah.
And I got to say that it's quite refreshing when I come off the tours from different countries all over the world to come back to especially Höllviken,
okay,
where nothing has changed in 20 years. I mean, if somebody puts up a new house, we know about it. We all go and look, you know. Yeah. You know, so it's really neat to have something that's 100% stable all the time.
Yeah.
Everybody knows your name.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so it's kind of cool.
Yeah.
I like it. I like it.
That's cool. And of course, like the big thing we're going to talk about today, or what you have built, is your Elite. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us about that concept and the story behind it?
Yeah. Here's what happened. I coached for Höllviken's Tennis Club for 10 years, 1994 to 2004. And there was no head coach there. It was myself, Hasse Goransson, Anders Monsen, and Christer Goransson that were the main coaches there, along with Rickard Anderberg, who was the sport chief.
Mm.
And we really got along well. And we all had our different areas that we were good at.
Mm.
And mine was that I didn't have a family to go back to, so I spent a ton of time with the kids working on technique, working on tactics. I didn't really, none of us really punched a clock, but I also knew that the other guys had families. So we kind of all agreed that I would take the technical part and work with that and do the private lessons.
Okay. Because it took more time to do the private.
They were,
as well.
They took their family time away, and they were just, you know, Tim, everybody knows the Goransson family with Andre, Klaus, and Tim and Andy.
Pretty good players.
Pretty good players. But you know, they were just kids then. So, you know, have to raise a family, and that's a priority. So I was just happened to get in at the right time, and they really wanted to build a program that was more geared towards elite players and see how far we can go.
Mm.
And again, we each had our part. Mm. There was no head coach. We chose to have no head coach. We were all just the same, and we all had our different pluses.
Mm.
So at Höllviken's Tennis Club, then, kind of some people that I was working with more personally came to me and they said, "Hey, Johnny here at this club wants to come and join me for a lesson. Is that okay?" I said, "Well, if it's okay with his coach, club, sure." So one of them came.
Okay.
And then he would tell a friend, another friend.
Mm.
And then so all of a sudden, you know, they would ask for, "Hey, what are you doing on the weekend?" "Nothing. I don't really have much of a life. Let's do Saturday, Sunday. Come on over. Let's go." And sleep at your friend's house. Because this all started with Höllviken kids inviting their friends.
I understand. Okay.
And so this is how everything kind of started, that they started with some overnights and staying at each other's house. And then it got too big for houses. Then they started staying at my house. Then I bought a husvagn. And then we had our first summer camp, I think in 1996, and we had 30 kids.
Okay.
And I did it myself.
All by yourself?
All by myself.
All right.
Yep. It was when I was younger and a little bit lighter on my toes.
Well, you're still about
it. But it was hilarious. I had four kids indoors doing serves, returns, and then point play on three courts, and I was two courts feeding the ball, and I would scream rotate, and the neighbors would be going crazy with my voice because I've got quite a loud voice. And I had a blast.
Yeah.
So we started it with that. And then the word came out and they wanted to do more weekends. Yeah. And so then I asked Anders Monsen, can you help out a little bit? And he did. And then House of Fredborg came in and we started high performance camps. And
then it just grew.
It grew and grew. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And at one point you quit your job in Hölviken and mainly focused on this thing.
Yeah. The Hölviken gig ended in 2004.
Okay.
I did some work with Janne Immonen, who's one of my best buddies, at Fair Play.
Mm.
That was a really good situation where he and Fredrik Lund allowed me to choose the weeks I wanted to work because I love to tour.
Oh, yeah.
I love to tour. Yeah. It's
to be on the tournaments or to travel or
travel both. Both. It didn't matter. I'd love to go on I'd like to see kids playing under pressure and then work with them to try to polish up the areas they needed to polish up.
Yeah.
Charting matches, looking at them and talking with them afterwards. And there was a big need for that. You know, again, and I understand that small clubs, you have coaches that can't get out. They have families.
Yeah.
I could get out. I didn't have a family here. Those days are over already. And probably because of the travel.
maybe have something to do with it.
Yeah, that could have something to do with it. So, but those days were over. So I'd love to get out.
Okay.
And I think the first person I took out, and it was one-on-one, was Alexander Nedert.
Yeah,
from Halmstad. Yeah, I think Sundrum, maybe. Sundrum Tennis Club.
Probably, yes.
Yeah, we went to his parents' house. Can you take him to Germany for 2 weeks? And I did, and worked out. And then more kids wanted to go on tours, and all of a sudden, here we go.
So what became the purpose with it? Was it to bring out the kids to play international or to gather players from all over Sweden? Or did you feel like, okay, what was the idea?
Okay.
Besides that it was fun.
Yeah, well, it has to be fun first.
Yeah.
None of this for the money. You do this because you're having a great time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. If you're good at what you do, the money comes in and it's embarrassing sometimes because you're having so much fun. This is just what you do, what you wake up and do.
Yeah, yeah.
So, but having put that aside, the answer to your questions are yes, yes, yes. Fun. They needed to get out of Sweden because Sweden, I felt back 20 years ago, was a little bit too much internalizing. They stayed in the country too much.
Mm-hmm.
They got to see each other's games all the time. People were losing interest because they were just playing the same people over and over and over again. Why not get out?
Mm-hmm.
Why not go to Norway, Denmark, Czech Republic, Germany? It's a 1 hour flight away. It's a half an hour drive away. Let's go out.
Do you feel the same today?
Exactly. They're getting out a lot more now.
Okay.
Yeah, they're getting out a lot more now. I mean,
because of you or by themselves as well? What's your feeling?
They're getting out, I think, because they feel it's inspiring.
Mm-hmm.
They also don't want to play the same people over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
They a lot of the kids love to travel.
Mm-hmm.
They're doing it for college so they can get a higher ITF ranking or, you know, get experience on the Tennis Europe Tour before they get in the ITFs. So, yeah, I mean, the great's doing a super job at getting their kids out and getting a good program. Mm-hmm. We're doing a good job with 12s to 12, 14, 16s and ITFs pretty much every grade to get out and have the kids enjoy the traveling and the responsibility that comes with it. The discipline, when to wake up, how to work out. We teach the kids how to sign in. So, yeah, everybody, I think, needs to get out. And some people say, well, he's not ready or she's not ready. Mm. How do you know?
Because that was my next question. Do you think they need to be among the best in Sweden first before they go out?
Absolutely not.
No?
No.
And why not?
Because you're going there. Why are you going to a tournament? It has to come back to the core. Why do you go out? I'm going out to experience another culture.
Mm.
I'm going out to learn how to be away from mom and dad.
Mm.
I'm going out to learn how to find some discipline. Look at other people's strokes. What are the Spanish doing? What are the Czechs doing? What are the Germans doing? And coming back to Sweden with that information, you don't have to be top in your age group to go out and test international. That's why they have qualifying. Yeah. That's why there's qualifying events. You get to, you know, when somebody says, oh, I'm not in the main draw, so I don't want to go. Well, you have two tournaments then. You're so lucky. You get to play quali and then the main. So you have two events. You have to know the reason why. Why am I going out? And if it's just to win the tournament, well, then nobody would go out.
I've
been with top players. Again, Daniel Berthe, the Emer brothers, taking them out when they were 10, 11, 12, 13 years old. They didn't win the tournament, but they got a lot of experience. Learning what to do at a tournament, learning how to wake up, how to practice, how to prepare, making sure they eat right, they sleep right, they drink right. Everything is there for them to do. And I'm not saying you can't do that in Sweden, but I'm saying there's a little bit extra incentive when you're playing. I'm playing a kid from Japan. Yeah. Oh, I'm playing a kid from Czech Republic. Oh, those Germans, they have a really tough serve. They serve so hard. And that is cool for them to see. Win or lose, it doesn't really matter.
But do you think everybody knows why they go out to tournaments?
We tell them.
Okay, so but then you decide why they go out, or do you ask them what's your reason to follow on this trip?
Okay,
or so do you understand my question?
Yeah, I understand. We have camps.
Yeah.
Okay, let me regress a little bit. The reason we have a camp, high performance camps that the kids go to usually twice in a year, and then a summer camp. The camps are meant specifically to get you ready for the tour.
Okay,
we give you tour concepts that I've seen, I've learned over the years that have changed.
Yeah.
Yeah. We give you drills that deal with being on the tour. Yeah. Patterns of play, shot selections, decision making. Yeah. Because basically it comes down to decisions, doesn't it? How hard to hit a ball, how close to the line you choose to play a ball, what kind of spin you impart on the ball, what court position you go to after you hit the ball, what to expect. So there's a lot of different ways there. So that's what we do in our camps. And the idea with the tour is to say, look, go out one time a year just to change it up and see what happens. See if you catch the bug. See if that will inspire you to stay in the game longer. Because there's a lot of guys, as you all know, Linus, that they lose interest because they just stick around here.
Yeah.
You know?
That I know, yeah.
Yeah. And they play the same people over and over again. And then they say, oh, I'm not good enough to go out on the international tour. Sure you are. There's a place for everybody. It's just the same thing as people tell me, I'm not good enough to go to college. Sure you are. There's a college for everybody.
And I mean, I feel the same as a coach. I get inspiration when I go abroad to tournament or to a trip and probably makes a better job when I get home to my club again.
The idea is to always get information. You know, when you go on a Euro Elite Tour, if you lose, and we plan for the losers. We plan for the guys who are not going to make it. Because then we have courts already booked. We have friendly matches with other countries already contacted. But we want you to also go back to the tournament and make some notes. What are they doing? How are people winning? How are they losing? Yeah. What decisions are they making? You can learn a lot by being outside the court and seeing what's happening inside the court, even if you're not in the tournament anymore.
Yeah.
So it's not about going in there, I've got the first seed and the guy's tough and it's a 1 hour match, you know, one and one. And there goes a 7 day tour. Not true. You will learn every single day of those 7 days.
So I know, Dave, at the camps and the tours, you teach a lot about the values for the people, not just on the court, but mostly almost besides the court in life and stuff. Can you tell us a little bit about the values you try to teach the kids?
Sure. Everything is connected in life. The wheel has to be round and it has to be smooth. So our on-court and off-court discipline comes from, if we want to take the on-court first, we deal quite extensively with patterns of play. We believe in 5 or 6 patterns that are the most used. 2-1, we call it hammer play also. Then we have the cross-court pattern. We have coast-to-coast, 1-to-1 each corner, sneak play coming in. So there's a lot of patterns that we teach. We got that from Kevin Wilmington, I think his last name is. We put names on things because kids remember names. So the hammer play is simply just run around your forehand, your backhand to hit a forehand inside out or inside in. So they call it the hammer.
Use your hammer.
Yeah, use the hammer. So, but again, I got that from Kevin Garlington. Yeah. So I steal everything, by the way, and I'm unashamed about it. I'm on the internet all the time. I look at things, I study, because people have, you know, they don't have to come to your league. Mm-hmm. So we have to provide something new and exciting for them. So the patterns of play is huge. Mm-hmm. Next, after patterns, that's your basically your game style. Then you look at the shot selection. Mm-hmm. We teach shot selection. So you have to have some discipline in that shot selection, which means if you're not in a pattern, you're hitting a ball that is good for you to get back into the point. Somebody hits a drop shot. You have no pattern for that. Somebody gets you way in the corners. You don't have a real pattern for that. So you've got to make a shot selection based at that moment, based on what's good for your court position and to also hopefully not let the guy attack. The discipline in the shot selection, the discipline in the patterns of play, the discipline in what you're doing between the points should mirror the off-court discipline. The make your beds when you're waking up in the morning. Yeah, but the maids do it. No. You do it. Mm. You'll make your bed. Your room will be clean. Your bag will be tidy. Pretty much every tour we have. Boys, empty out your bags and clean them. Yeah. Now, we've found some pretty nasty things in those bags. I mean, liquefied bananas, stuff like that. So a lot of the guys are glad they did that. Yeah. But you have to know where everything else in your bag is. That's your bag. That's your office. That's the kit you use to survive out there in the match.
Yeah.
So we have them empty, clean, put it back. You know where everything is. Eating correctly, lining up your shoes, taking your hat off when you eat, saying thank you for the meal, thank you for the training. We try to teach the kids to be grateful for what they have. And that also means grateful for hitting a tennis ball, grateful to the parents who are paying for this, grateful to the club and the club coaches who have allowed them to be able to go on a tour with your elite or whomever you choose. Because at the end of the day, the only reason kids come to your elite is because of the good work that's happening at the club. Yeah. The club has to do all that grinding every day. We get to see them for 3 days. Yeah. Every 4 months, 3 days. So when you're in your elite project, you have a high performance camp for coming on a Thursday night. You do Friday, Saturday, Sunday, off you go. Okay. Then we'll see you about 4 or 5 months later. Thursday night, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, off you go. That's 6 days total. Yeah. Then summer camp, 4.5 days. What has to happen in those times is that we have to impart our values. We've got to impart what's happening here on the court and off the court for you to take back to the clubs. But also I have to say to the kids, this is the icing on the cake. Because if your club coach didn't get you good enough to get invited here, then you wouldn't be knowing these things.
But what you teach at the, for example, camps then, do you feel that that's something the clubs are missing to do?
Some, sure, of course. They, you know, we stay away from the pointing and the arrows. It's a futile experiment to do that. What we have to point out is that there is another way to do things. Some like our way, some don't. Some like Pepsi, some like Coke. You choose how it is, really. I mean, you know, at the end of the day, we're not for everybody, nor do we want to be. You know, I've had a lot of parents come to me and say, hey, you know, if you're a little bit, maybe you could let that slide or do this or do that, then you'd have a lot more kids. Well, no, I don't want that kind of kid then. I want the kids who do this and the parents who do that.
But don't you think that's why your elite have become kind of successful, that you do what you feel is the right thing?
Yeah.
That you don't like do what the parents ask sometimes.
No, we don't compromise.
Yeah, exactly. That's
very,
what I'm
very
to
little,
say.
Very little do we bend. You know, obviously there are going to be some cases that we should because we're human.
Yeah.
But no, this is how it is. And if you like what we do, come along. If you don't, well, that's okay. You can go there. And this is, again, why we've been here 25 years. This is my 25th year here, 20 years with your elite. You know what to expect now. This is not 20 months, it's 20 years. So you know the values we're asking you to do. You know, we want you to be polite. You know, we want you to when you're across the, if I'm across the court from you, Linus, and I've traveled all the way from Pitu, yeah, to come down to Helviken, two flights, then a bus, which I think is what Arvid was doing, Norin, yeah. He's come a long way.
Yeah.
People fly in from Stavanger. They've come a long way and paid a lot of money to come, besides the camp, to be there. You better be good on that other side. You better give 110%. And if you do, everything is great. You can miss as much as you want. We can help you with that. But if your attitude is bad, if you don't work, yeah, then this isn't the place.
No. But what you teach, is that what you as a person believed in when you started this thing?
I had to work hard. I wasn't very good at tennis. I didn't have very much talent at this sport. I did through repetition and hard work. And I never really understood the talented guys. I played them and I beat them. Earlier they beat me. But at the end of the day, hey, everything I did, I had to do through hard work. There was no luck involved. And so I try to still keep those values. We're looking for not the ultra talented guys. We're looking for just, you know, the guys who like this type of management on and off the court. I got a letter from a parent just last week. They really enjoyed the structure.
Okay.
Yeah. They like to know that this is happening at these times, but then also they have some free time.
Yeah.
You know, you have your on-court time. Let's do some work here. We do 55 minutes of hard work. Then 5 minutes, we'll play Olympics.
Yeah.
You know, just relax a little bit. Yeah. It's a little fun and then get some water.
Yeah.
Make notes when you're on the court. Something got you something. One of the coaches told you something. Make a note of it. A drill you like, make a note. Take the notebook on the court. Pass it along to your friends or to your coaches, but they like not just the discipline, because that's sometimes a bad word for some people. But they like the structure.
Yeah, I understand.
That they can do a lot of things, you know, that we go out to play, do go-kart or laser dome or whatever, you know, so it's important to have fun in life, but it's important to, when it's time to work, it's work time.
So from time to time, we hear that, we think that the Scandinavian juniors are too spoiled sometimes, or kids are too spoiled. We have it too good. We our families earn kind of a lot of money, and you need to people from other country need to strive for something more in life. Do you think this is one of the reasons Sweden have not been so successful the last couple of years? Or do you
last
do you,
couple
can,
of years?
Like many years. Or can you feel that we are more spoiled here in Scandinavia?
Spoiled is a hard word. I don't know that I would use that word. I think privileged could be a better word.
Probably, yes. The language barrier.
Yeah, that's fine. But, you know, privilege, it's not the child's fault. It's not the parents' fault that they make money. That's good for them. I like that. I mean, there's a lot of people who don't think people should make money in this society. You know, when somebody tells me they've negotiated a great contract, good for you. You know, go for it. They're more privileged, and I think one of the areas, you know, with this phone, for example, you know, I have a thing about these phones. We take them away at camps and tours. You know,
I know,
because you don't. Yeah, you know, they you're supposed to use them. They're not supposed to use you.
Yeah, I understand.
And a lot of times, they become just too addicted to this thing, and so we take those away. But the privilege is one thing, and I go to Czech Republic a lot. I like to base a lot of what we do on the there. I have really good friends at the National Tennis Center. In fact, I was just there last month doing a camp with 8-10 kids, and then was with a couple of kids and doing some grade threes or grade twos, but. In the Czech Republic, they've had a little bit tougher time. The parents have, you know, being under Russia for a while, and they've got a little bit of the Eastern Bloc mentality of working hard and getting out and you know, again, business. But they've also found a way to have the pleasure too. They do have their phones, but I talk to a lot of Czech parents, and they actually do take away those phones at night when Junior says good night. That phone is out of the room. Yeah, they're not going to be having that phone.
Okay.
In the morning, they'll give it to them for communication purposes or whatever, but at night, that's it. So to answer your question, has it something to do with the success or lack of success for Swedish players or Scandinavian players? Probably. A little bit too privileged. Maybe a little bit too much. The parents aren't as tough as they could be.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I get mails. Oh, I wish I could take away their phone. Well, you can.
Yeah.
Oh, I wish I could make them put their shoes in a line there. I saw the photo of the shoes all in line. Well, you can.
Yeah.
Of course you can do that. You just have to do it.
Yeah, I understand. Yeah.
So,
how do you work with the parents?
What's your... Next question. Don't you know by now?
Okay. How do you deal with the parents' question?
There you go.
Everything like that.
Okay. So I try to do a parent meeting every year. One in Stockholm, one in Oslo, one in Malmö, and one in Copenhagen. Those are our main areas. And we go over, they have questions like they should about things. Look, we are not a primary coach academy. We're not the primary coach. We're a secondary coach. We're here to complement the club, complement the home coach. Prime, which I have now, is a little bit of a different animal. It's a hybrid. But over, by and large, the parents have a program to follow. We only ask the parents to do a couple of things. When you're chosen to sign up for the project, read all the rules. Then if you say yes, then keep your word. It's very simple. Keep your commitments. Very simple. Yeah. Don't change. If you don't like it after a year, well, then don't renew. Don't sign up again, but keep your commitment for the year. That shows your child, your player. Oh, I don't want to go there anymore. Well, son, you signed up for it. Yeah. You're going to go. Yeah. We paid money for this. And so I think it's easy to quit. It's not so easy to keep it going. But what I found is when we have new players and they come for their first camp and it's a little bit tough and it's long days and it's early in the morning waking up. We play from 7 to 9 in the morning and then we eat breakfast. People aren't quite used to that. Yeah. And they come home tired and they don't know if they like it. They usually are fine the second time. Yeah. But I actually love working with parents. I've gotten some of the best ideas working with the parents that I've known for years. Our average stay, and I was telling Thierry, our average stay is 5 years. Five years for a project member.
Okay.
Yeah. 5 years is the average. So in that 5 years, I get to know some of the parents. Now, in 5 years, there's some parents, they could walk up to me, and I have no clue who they are. I have never seen their face. You know, they sign up or they do this and they
email, yeah.
Yeah, the email, because that's all I do. I don't do phone calls.
Why not?
Because once I open that box, then I get calls at 4 in the afternoon, 6 at night, 9 at night. There's no grenzen. There's no border.
No.
So that I absolutely put a lid on.
Okay.
People can talk to me if something is going on with their child or something happens. Or if I feel like I need to talk to you and the email is not going to really get my feelings out, because emails are horrible for that. I found that out. They can be misread very easily. So it's better maybe to have a phone call so you can listen to their voice. But I set that up. I set up the time and the date.
Okay.
And because I'm an old man. I get grumpy sometimes.
Well, yeah. How old are you nowadays?
Now I turned 64.
64.
Yeah, this year.
Yeah.
Yeah, November.
We'll soon
pensionar.
Oh, yeah.
No, I'm half now since I sold the camps part of EuroLeague. I'm kind of half pensionar. No, but I love parents, and we all have to know, however, our area.
Yeah.
You know, we have to know our area. We have to know that we can walk arm in arm, but not always see eye to eye on everything. But if you've joined EuroLeague, that means you've trusted us to do the right thing. Again, we've been here 25 years, not 25 months. So we haven't lost a kid yet, you know. and that's not saying that everybody likes all the time we do. We have some guys that only do one season.
Yeah,
fair enough. That's fine. But the average is 5, and so I think we're doing some things okay.
Like you've said, Dave, you love to travel and you go on tours and tournaments and stuff. Do you know how many Tennis Europe or ITFs you've been to?
Oh, Lord. No, I don't. I mean, I wish I could do the average and I could say, all right, My average is about maybe 20 tournaments a year. At least 10 years for that amount. So that's 200, and then just add on from there. It's a lot. It's quite a few, and each one is some people ask, what is your best? What is
was my next question.
What is your favorite? Asia. One for ITF. Yeah,
okay.
For the ITF tour. I love Malaysia. I love the people there.
Yeah.
Thailand is always fun. But that's a 5-week tour. It's usually 4 tournaments in a row. Mm-hmm. Used to include Vietnam, which was just marvelous. Yeah. Wonderful, beautiful people there in Vietnam. Well, you know that because we've been there. So we did that. So Asia is a fantastic tour, especially, the time of year.
Yeah.
When it starts to get ugly here.
You're going where is it? October?
All of
November?
October. Pretty much all of October. Yeah.
It's perfect place in the calendar.
Oh, it's wonderful. Yeah, it's absolutely wonderful. So, yeah, Asia for the grade threes and fours. Mm. Then South America tour is incredible for the grade ones. Mm. That's Costa Rica, Colombia, Ecuador, and Paraguay. Been doing that one for about 20 years in a row. Mm. So that's fun. It used to be Venezuela, but that didn't work out too well right now. So
okay.
They stopped that one about 4 years ago.
Yeah.
Actually, Philip Berry won that one.
Singles
and doubles.
Yeah.
Singles and doubles. So that's also a good one. Tennis Europe, Slovenia for sure is my favorite in May.
Okay.
In Maribor.
I've been there as well.
Yeah. 10 days. Usually it's two tournaments in a row.
Yeah.
And we get different groups flying in, flying out. So it's usually about 30 kids, 35.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So it's a wonderful place to go. And and not to say anything wrong with Germany and Austria and Czech Republic and everything, but those are my favorites.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sometimes people say it's good to go a bit far away to get some easy points sometimes. Is it easier fields in Asia, for example?
Yeah,
than in Europe?
Africa is easier.
Okay.
we do go to Africa a lot.
Okay.
We Kenya, Rwanda, I think the kids were in Botswana and Namibia 1 year. Mm. But we tell them this, look, when I was talking with Thierry, who hopefully will have a podcast later, who's in charge of East Africa and Central Africa ITF, one of the things we do tell the kids is that if you get your points in Africa, this is points that you got that some areas are not quite as strong as other areas. So don't come back and think that I'm something now.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What you have to do is just be grateful that now you're on the board, because that's really the idea.
And that's a positive thing to be.
That's a positive thing
to get into other tournaments.
You got one point. You're going to get into pretty much every grade five.
So what you're saying is there's an idea why you should go and get some, let's say, easier points.
There obviously are easier zones than others, but I have to tell you too, sometimes Africa is strong.
Yeah, of course.
In there, we go to Mauritius every year. We've been there 8 years in a row, except for last year. And sometimes it's easier. We've won that, I think, 3 or 4 times. Sometimes it's very tough. So it depends on the on the
and
rotation
you can have
of
bad,
the year.
Bad and good luck in the draw.
Yeah, I mean that's nature of the game.
Yeah.
But one of the reasons we like to go to Africa is it's just such a different culture, and it's a wonderful life experience to see the nature and to see the people and to go out to a safari, and everything is so totally different. It's really neat. Should that be your first tour? No. Stick around Scandinavia.
Okay.
You have plenty here. Kramfors, you have got Oslo.
But
Stavanger.
If you go to Kramfors or Stavanger, you tend to play the same players like you do in the national tournaments sometimes.
Yeah, but it's still, if you're not used to traveling, it's still, traveling to Kramfors, there we go.
Yeah.
But also to Stavanger or to Bergen or wherever. If you can stick around and get those points, that's great. A little bit tougher around here because, for example, I think we had a whole group of Italians in Kramfors.
Yeah, exactly.
2 years ago. Yeah. I mean,
they're pretty good.
They took the whole thing. They stayed for 2 weeks.
Yeah.
So that was a tough year.
Yeah.
But you know, there's a lot of times where Kenya, for example, is only a 6-hour flight. Yeah. It's straight down. There's no time difference. It's a very safe country. You know, we wouldn't go unless it was. And that's one of the things that we want the parents to also know. We choose based on safety. And, you know, with the flights, if I don't like a flight path, we'll pay more to get a flight path that I like that's not flying over a conflict zone or whatever. Because now I have to do that. I never used to have to do that. But after the Ukraine situation happened, now I have to look at the flight path of that particular airline. And I got to say, well, okay, no, we're not going to take that one. We'll pay 1,000 crowns more and take this flight. So, yeah, those are the favorite ones. And those are the ones that you have to, you know, you've got to be able to get those important first points. Yeah. There's a lot of guys going out now. I was just looking at the ITF schedule, regardless of the pandemic. They're going to fairly safe countries, but some aren't. Because they know other kids aren't going to go. And so it's a free-for-all now.
Yeah, I understand.
There's a lot of guys who wouldn't have gotten points where they are now. Good for them.
Yeah.
You know?
When you have traveled the world to different for tournaments and for like camps and stuff, can you see differences in how tennis is taught in different areas of the world?
Oh, yeah.
Can you explain a little bit if you...
Sure. Look, I kind of mentioned it a little bit earlier. You look at and this is a generalization. You look at the Germans, you know, big serves, big forehands, and they're pretty proficient at the net. This is their base. Okay. Then you look at the Spanish, heavy spins. They're able to grind it out. You know, good heavy top spins, good height. They drop shots, and anytime they want to hit drop shots, so their depth changes are incredible. The Italians are a mix of that. A lot of emotion, but Italy is putting out some really solid players in juniors as well. Right now, the Czech Republic is really an all court game. Guys, you know, they can grind it out. They can hit flat, hard. They can spin it. So they can do a lot of things also. So yeah, you could see the differences in who's doing what. The Japanese, when I see their national team on the tour, I mean, they're out at 5:30 in the morning, just grinding. You know, they not missing, and every shot, boom, the same, basically the same. But you know, they're not gonna miss. You know, this is it. So they all have different little mindsets on how they practice. You know, we were with the Brazilians. I was with Leo Borg and Oscar Paulsen at the Grade 1 events last year. This year, actually. January.
Exactly. This year.
Costa Rica and Colombia. And we were kind of hanging out with the Brazilians. They were pretty funny guys.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
And they ended up winning pretty much all the tournaments. Different ones, but they pretty much were dominating. These guys had such an interesting way to train. They were very loose, very relaxed, and not that disciplined. It didn't look like, but when it came to the match time, it was all business.
Okay.
Yeah. So it was really interesting to see that personality of them coming in, and they're joking around, and we trained with them. Yeah. We trained with them quite a few times, played some doubles against them. And it was, pretty funny.
Okay.
Actually.
And how would you say that the Swedish players, how is our style when you get, because you get so many kids from all of the country coming in to you, can you see some like trend or how do you say
when, once you get up to the grade one level, it's going to be the same. You know, you have Mons, you have Leo, you have Isak, you have Timothy, and you know, these guys on the O3s levels that are serious guys, and the coaches are good, and they've been around the block, so they know how to get their kids prepared.
Okay.
Maybe they don't do the exactly same things we do. We make game plans written before they go on, and they finish the paperwork afterwards. We have a court health paper that they put on the bench just to help them get a pathway back if they're losing a match. We have certain things we do. But by and large, you know, I don't know, when I take the kids more on the Tennis Europe tours, Linus, you know, there's a lot of work to be done. Because, you know, when they
like
go to,
what?
When they go to Swedish tours, you know, they kind of get out of the car and they just walk in and they skip rope or they jog for 5 minutes and they get on the court and they play. There is no, you know, let's call Johnny and see if we can get a hit at 6:30 a.m. And then I can go take a shower and then, you know, relax a little bit, have some breakfast, put on my earphones and focus. And then I, and then the actual warm up of the tournament, when, if I'm playing you in a tournament, I'm not really warming up anymore. I've already warmed up an hour and a half before this.
Yeah, that
warm up is done. What I'm doing now is I'm hunting you. That's what I'm doing. So this isn't a warm up. I'm testing your forehand. I'm testing your backhand. Can you run? Can you hit a volley? Can you hit an overhead? So when it's match time and I'm playing against another player, our guys are not warming up anymore. They're hunting you. They're formulating their game plan against you. So it's nothing about the warm up. And this is where I feel it's a little bit lacking. Overall in Scandinavia. So where they don't really go out of their way. Generally, some do, and I've seen that. But generally, they don't go out of their way to get a hit, you know, an hour before their match, and then take a shower and get fresh, and then write a plan or whatever. But they get out of the car, skip rope, and they walk on the court, and their 10-minute warm up is their warm up. And then they play a match. A lot of this can't be helped, you know. But I think some can with some good planning.
And do you feel like the other players from other countries are a little bit in
they're more disciplined
than this? Better than us.
They're more disciplined in that area. Maybe because they have to be, because there's a lot of tough competition in Germany, Austria, you know, Czech, Poland.
In Sweden, they get away with not doing
they get
it.
Because everybody's not doing it, then they can get away with it. So, but there, you know, you get you're going to be the loser if you're not. If you're not prepared correctly. You know, when I was in, I was just in Rakovnik 6-8 weeks ago. At the grade two. And you know, there were several people who beat us on the court. You know, waking up early and you know, hitting and then taking shower and eating and getting everything ready. That's it's good stuff.
I'm thinking like the top tournaments you've been to for the juniors, like it's just what is grade
the grade ones,
and the best juniors there. What are they like especially good at?
Keeping the ball in play.
Is it that easy?
Height, spin, depth changes, especially depth changes. You know, they're able to get the guy pushed back and then put a pop a short angle out. You know, and hit drop shots at will. But another thing they're really good at is recognizing an opportunity to hurt the guy. You know, after their consistency, after they get the guy pushed out of the court where they want to be, they can pretty much punish a ball. And still not come close to the line, not come that close to the net, and either win the point outright or they just come to the net and put the next ball away easily. So the top guys are first and foremost consistent. They know how to get another ball in the court, most of the time cross. They know how to push their opponent back, move them from side to side, and and they're patient. They wait for that ball. When Chahud, when I was with Kevin Chahud in 2018 and he won Columbia grade one at that time, he wasn't hitting flat, hard, making all the mistakes. I think in a month being with Kevin, he maybe hit the net, I would say 6-7 times. Serious. I never hit the net. In Costa Rica, he played way too far back. He adjusted. And he adjusted because he wanted to win a grade one so he could play grand slams. So he would do whatever it took. And that's why I really liked working with Kevin in that respect. Is that it didn't matter. Okay, coach, here we go. I had to show him a video of him playing so far back. He didn't believe it. I was 3 meters behind the baseline. But then he adjusted. He went forward. He corrected it. And Colombia, although not easy, I mean, he beat Martin Dam in the semifinals, 3.5-hour match. And he finished it off with a drop shot. Backhand drop shot. He ran Martin in. And then he block lobbed him. And that was the end of the match.
That's pretty
good. So, it was fantastic. But when Kevin ran to a ball, he would get the ball over the net. He would get the, and these guys almost never hit the net.
Okay.
They always get that ball up first.
And how do you teach that as a coach? Or how do you think they have become, like, the best players have become good at this?
Well, look, there's certain things that are true. Never has anybody called Hawkeye hitting the net, have they?
No.
They've hit the net and they say, hey, Hawkeye, challenge.
No. I mean, that would be the first time.
That's the first thing you have to avoid. That's the only thing that hinders you on the court that stands up. That's the only hinder. That's the first thing you got to clear.
Mm.
So the first thing in your head is, how much do I want to clear the net by?
Mm.
Yeah, anybody can clear the net.
Mm.
Anybody. I was out 2 days ago with my prime guys. They were hitting the net all the time. And I don't play anymore. My body's breaking down. But I said, give me that racket. I didn't hit the net one time because I didn't want to. That's the first thing you do.
But then you talk about the mentality, more or less.
Well, it is a mentality. It is a decision to suffer again. Yeah. Not to hit this trick shot or this fancy shot.
Mm-hmm.
Because again, Kevin, and I'll bring Kevin up again. Mm. The guy's a grinder.
Mm.
He did learn how to step up and take a ball flat.
Mm.
He did learn how to drop shot and get to the net. He knew that already, but he did a little bit more. And he popped a little bit more on a serve. Having said that, his base is consistency. Heavy spins, giving balls that the other guy hates to play.
Mm.
Because just like Craig O'Shaughnessy says, what is your job on the tennis court? Mm. To make the guy play bad.
Mm.
To make the other guy play bad.
Mm.
And you can only do that by putting that ball over that net and putting the ball in.
Mm.
It's better to let them hit a winner than for you to miss in that net.
Mm.
Yeah, let them hit that winner, okay? But I've seen, and you've probably seen being on the tour as well, I've seen people miss the easiest shots in the world, and it gets right between their ears when they do that. Well, that would never have happened had you hit the net. But if you put up a sitter and the guy misses it wide, misses it in the net, he's going to go crazy.
Yeah.
Or you just got inside his head.
Mm.
But so this is what I'm telling the kids. And we develop drills based on penalties for hitting the net, penalties for hitting wide, and a very small penalty for hitting long.
Mm. Mm.
So, we call it Australian countdown because I stole it from the Australian team.
Okay.
If during a duel, you would hit the net, minus 3 points. Everybody starts with 15.
Mm.
Yeah. You try to keep those points or go above it with different types of winners.
Yeah.
You hit the net, minus 3. You hit wide, minus 2.
Mm.
And if a point ends long, only minus 1.
Okay.
Yeah. You hit an ace, plus 2. Oh. You hit a winner from behind the baseline. It's, not often you do that. So we give them a plus 1.
Okay.
Yeah. But if you go to the net and you hit a winner, or you hit a drop shot winner, there's a plus 2.
So you award in different ways.
Different ways, yeah. Okay. If your problem is hitting wide, well, then make the wide minus 3.
Yeah.
Yeah, and make the net minus 2.
Mm.
You can manipulate this drill however you like or customize it.
Mm.
But it's mentality. It's, do I want to suffer again?
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm. Do you think you have changed your coaching style a lot over the years?
Sure.
In what way?
Oh, well, I'm a kind of a screamer.
Are you?
Yeah.
No
I'm
way.
A yeller. But it's not that way where I'm yelling really bad things. It's basically a lot of encouragement or it's kind of joking with a little bit of humor in it.
Yeah.
Because if you don't have the humor, you scare people.
Mm.
I have a fairly good sense of humor. And
so
if you can manage those both the humor and the toughness then I think that's better. When I came off of college coaching, I was pretty rough.
Okay.
Yeah, it was because there
you were too rough.
Too tough? Yeah, it was too tough. Yeah. It was do or die there. If you don't win, you lose your job in the States, I think Sweden has been good for me in that area where I could, what I do now is you have to know who you can talk loud to and who you can't.
Mm.
But I've done this for the last 10 years now. I'm learning, still learning to coach better and reading books, getting ideas. I like Coach Wooten from UCLA basketball team.
Yeah. A legend.
Legend of coaching. And I still read his books and he never said the word win.
Mm.
Never. It was always about performing, and that's what I also like.
Yeah.
Everybody knows about wanting to win,
mm.
but if you perform well and you do those things that will prepare you to perform well, then those W's will come.
Yeah.
Point, you know, so as somebody says, you know, I've been playing tennis Europe, so I've been playing ITFs now for 2-3 years and I haven't gotten quite, well, you're not ready yet. Something's missing there.
Yeah.
And as soon as you shape that up, whether it's your preparation before, you know, whether it's maybe you're not learning enough after the losses, maybe you're doing the same mistakes over and over again. And that, according to Einstein, is madness. Yeah. And expecting a different result. Well, that's not going to happen.
No.
Yeah. So you have to, you have to adjust.
Yeah.
You know, 'cause that's what this thing is, you know, you know, even, you know, going back to the South America tour, you know, one week we're on at Costa Rica at 1,000 meters. Then we're in Colombia at 0 meters on hard. Then we go to the clay court in Ecuador at 2,600 meters.
Different challenges every week.
Different challenges every week. You have to adjust.
Yeah.
But you know, the bottom line, you know, with the kids and getting them to do the right things and not make the same mistakes over and over again, a lot of it has to do with them doing the paperwork after their tournaments, after their matches, because so many people come off the court and they say, oh, I played good, or I played bad, and that's it. Or he played better, or I was good on the first set, and then they, you know, they played better in the second set. But that's
typical answers.
You're not specific. You have to be specific about what you want to learn. And if you're not learning, if you don't get information after every match, then you're just going to keep doing the same thing over and over again, and you won't get where you want to get.
Can you see, if you look abroad, like in like a international, can you see some trend in the coaching styles in general? If it's getting like the coaches are getting tougher, or are they getting more laid back, or can you see some trend?
But on the ITF tour, we'll take that. You know, I have probably the most fun on the higher level tours because the coaches are a lot more professional.
Okay.
They're more gracious. They tend to be more friends than adversarial. We work with each other. The kids already know what they want. If you're at a grade one level, you've done fairly well.
Yeah, exactly.
In the lower levels, the cheating isn't really as there. Et cetera. The coaches are a lot easier to get along with there.
Okay.
When you start going to the fives, and this is generally speaking, when you get fives and fours, you know, a lot of the coaches are really young.
You look
with all respect, everybody's listening. Everybody's young. When I'm looking at them now at my age, but they're very young. A lot of their, emotions and a lot of their wants are going on to the kids, which is making the kids nervous. A lot of their own self-worth they feel has to do with the outcome of that match that this young man is or young woman is playing. And so they become very adversarial, or they're coaching way too much on, you know, their player, and they're getting too upset with them, and you know, putting their hands up. And so I see a lot more of that in the lower levels. Again, mainly probably because they're younger coaches. Usually they send the younger coaches to the fours and fives and threes rather than the ones. Mostly those are the national coaches, and they've been there and done that already. So, but I don't know that I think the guys would be a lot more, the coaches at a younger level would be a lot more, serving to the kids if they had routines themselves to do. Again, write down your game plan. What do you know about this player? How did you play your last match? What were the best things about your last match? What did you do well? And basically, if you don't know the player, you have to focus on your game, but then you've got to be able to adjust to certain things that they do. Then when they're finished with the match, it's so important. I think it's so vital to write down what went right, what went wrong, what you need to work on.
You're learning.
So you have a blueprint of what to do next. And there you grow step by step. Every time you walk on the court, can I get a little bit better? And then you have no ceiling. You go as high as you want, you know, with that kind of an attitude.
You touched upon cheating which is sometimes a subject when you go to junior tournaments and stuff. Can you see
sometimes.
No, okay. Oof. Can you see a lot of cheating happening, and how do you like talk with your kids about handling that?
Cheating is really bad, actually. I was in, I think, Turkey a couple of years ago in the 12s, and the 12-year-olds were, it was vicious.
Okay.
It was horrible. I mean,
in that young age,
that young age. And that's what really made me sad.
Okay.
I was with, the Belgian national coach, who's a very good friend of mine. And, we couldn't believe that some of the other coaches that were with their kids would just be sitting there and not say anything.
Mm.
They say nothing. They're sitting on the line. They know that ball was 10 centimeters in, and yet they would allow that child to cheat.
Mm.
What does that teach that kid?
Mm.
What kind of value? Mm. Not winning at all costs, really? Mm. Is it worth it to teach that kid that's okay to do?
Yeah.
It was disgusting.
And what do you say to your kids? How to handle it if it happens in their match?
Well, no, you have to use the rule of law. You've got there's a reason that there's umpires there. Mm. There's a reason that there's a head umpire there.
Mm.
You've got to know when to call, how to call. Mm. You try to do things yourself. If you're 12, haven't lived on earth long enough to deal with that.
No.
Really, you haven't. You're just learning to brush your teeth correctly when you're 12. So that's the tough one. And that's why I really was sad about watching these 12-year-olds cheat purposely. And they did it always at the same time, game ball, break ball.
Mm.
Before that, they were okay.
Mm.
But if they had anything that was close, it was out. What we tell our kids is that it's going to happen.
Mm.
Okay? A lot of times people test you to see if you can handle it or not. If you lose your blob, if you totally, all they have to do is cheat you once or twice and you lose the game, well, shame on you.
Mm. Mm.
Yeah? You got to be stronger than that.
Mm.
So, I mean, there's certain ways we tell the kids to walk up to the net, not scream, not yell, not go crazy, and just go, how much was that out? I hate the question, are you sure? I hate that question. Because in my 45 years of coaching, I've never seen another human being on the other side say, oh, you know what? You're right. I'm not sure about that. That's yours. Not one time. So why are you asking, are you sure? That's so dumb. I hate it. So we always tell the kids, how much was that out?
Huh? Okay.
Yeah. Okay. And, you know, we have a lot of nice kids that are on the tour that will give a lot of points away.
Mm.
You know, they call them bad. I mean, the ball's out, you know, three, four centimeters, and they'll call it good. Well, that's fine. It's okay. I have no problem with that. You talk to them later on. They'll figure it out.
Mm.
But I'd rather have them that way than the other way.
Yeah.
The second time this happens, then you have to go to the referee and you got to say, look, can you watch?
Yeah.
Yeah. Because I, you know, this is.
And then he hopefully
stays there and takes care of it. Then, you know, but here's one thing I tell all the kids, they can't cheat if you really put the ball a half a meter in.
You need to play with margins.
Play with a better margin.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you can still win a ton of matches that way. And then I show Nadal and Djokovic slugging it out on animalistic rallies.
That's probably the best advice.
Get the ball in more, you know. So
right. Okay, Dave, I think no one in Sweden have a better picture of the level in Swedish junior tennis than you have
seen a lot
than
of
you
kids.
Have got over the last 25 years.
Mm-hmm.
Can you reflect on how the level on the mostly the boys side then, because that's what you mainly worked with, how the level is compared in an international perspective? How are we like standing, or what are we lacking, or what do we need to improve more in general?
In general?
Yeah.
I think, and again, this is just an opinion. What I can see is we don't have enough fitness programs.
Okay.
In tennis at the club level to get the guys to have a program before they get on the court.
Mm.
Then they have their maybe 1.5 hours on court and then a program when they finish.
Mm.
The most successful programs I have seen have this. The most consistent countries that have not had a dip like we've had in the level of player at the highest levels have this in their club makeup.
Okay.
It's not easy to do. let's bring back the privilege part. It's easier to be on the phone, to lay in bed, than to go out and kick the can. Back in the old days, you know, they didn't have the phones. They were outside doing other games and doing fitness and things. They didn't even know they were doing fitness. But I think that would be one of the biggest areas.
Okay.
That the kids are not fit enough to be able to last and have the confidence to last through a match or to finish off a match. Now, if you put that towards the consistency level, that has to do with your legs. You know, can I stay in there? Can I, again, suffer longer than the other guy? And that has exactly to do with fitness. The fitness and the mentality are tied together. And the fitness and the decision making of what you choose to do with the ball, whether I go cross court again and play again after a 10-15 ball rally, where it's a third set and you've been out there for 3 hours and it's hot, whatever, or are you going to go for the winner down the line because you just can't handle it anymore? Mentally / physically, you can't handle the pressure anymore. So this is one of the areas that I think we're a little bit lacking at. You know, that it's a very, having privilege means you're having things fixed for you quickly. Even I catch myself on the internet going like, why isn't it, what's going on? Why isn't it going faster? Why isn't it, you know, I just have to wait another half second and it would be on.
Yeah.
But then I'm getting angry because it's not fast enough.
Yeah.
We want everything fast now. We want everything right here.
Yeah.
Yeah? And tennis isn't always that way. So depending on who you get and the conditions, you know, you got to be able to be out there and suffer. And a lot of that has to do with fitness or lack of fitness. So that's what I've seen countries that are continuing, the Czech Republic, Spain, you know, at the Rafa Academy, I know that Leo was there and he did tons of fitness there.
But what age do you have in mind when you say that we lack this? Is it from like 12s or is it from 16s? Or
no, 12s.
From very early.
You could do a lot of things when you're 12s. I mean, I've taken 11-year-olds to the Czech Republic, for example, every year, not this year, but the years before.
Yeah.
And we would play against their guys, but also we'd be doing fitness against their guys. It's incredible. They can run faster backwards than we can forwards. they can do the Stegen, the ladder, while what is this called? Doing the three tennis balls,
juggling. Yeah.
While juggling the balls forwards and backwards and not lose their balance. It's incredible.
Yeah.
So it doesn't particularly have to be hard physical lifting weights and all things like that. It's a coordination, flexibility, things like that. That is the biggest thing. Second area, technique. Okay. I had a discussion with a coach recently. And, you know, when I was coaching in Hulviken for 10 years, I wanted to give every single player the best opportunity they had to go play college tennis.
Okay.
And that means as early as I could, I gave them good technique. I worked, I sweated. It's not easy. People don't listen. Parents maybe don't like it, but who cares? Sometimes you just got to, you know, hopefully they'll trust you.
Sorry
about that. Anyway, so I did my best to give them the best technique I could so that they could have a decision to make a choice later if they wanted to pursue this. Or, you know, play another sport. And I hope that if parents are listening to this, if you have another sport to play, play it. Do football, do ice hockey, do it until they're ready to choose one sport. But I think it's great to go on a team sport. I think it's super cross-training to do that. It also gets your mind off of just one thing, putting all your eggs in one basket. So it's the fitness thing, but I think the technical areas, it's really lacking here. You'll find some hot spots in Sweden, Norway, Denmark, where the coaches really like that and you can see it. When I get new kids into your elite and I don't know who they are, I can a lot of times look at their strokes and know where they came from.
That's amazing.
It's really interesting. And most of the time I'm right. Sometimes I'm wrong, but you know, One of the things I had a little bit of a disagreement with is playing for fun. Kids who come in once or twice a week and they're the base and they're the financial base and they're paying to come in once or twice. Oh, they're just playing for fun. So we put out the green dot balls and we let them play games and they stay in for a long time, but they don't. And I hate that. I'll be honest. I don't like that at all. I think that you should treat every kid as if he was a future star. And you give them all of the technical areas that could happen, that they could really say, hey, ooh, I like this. And I still know how to hit a forehand and a backhand and a serve. And now instead of doing 1 hour a week in the fun group, I want to do 2 hours a week and then 3 hours a week. We had a boy in Hulviken called, his name, I hope it's okay to say this, Olinus Olsen. Okay. Who has actually now moved back with he and his wife and child back to Hulviken.
Okay.
Nobody thought he would be any good. Nobody would thought. He was spraying balls all over the place. His dad would watch me from the lectere, from the up watching in Hulviken tennis club, and he would look about three or four balls and he'd just say, hey, good luck, Dave, you know, and then duck one of the balls that almost hit him over the head, you know. But this boy loved tennis. Mm-hmm. He just loved hitting a ball. Uh-huh. And it wasn't easy. Yeah. Kept him in the game.
Okay.
Started to get good. Ended up 15 or 20 in Europe or in Sweden, and went to college.
Okay.
And played college tennis. Journey. Okay. All because this kid that was playing for fun with a passion, myself, Hasse Goransson, and Anders Munson, we wanted to give him the skills to, hey, you can have a choice. But if you just let it go and just throw balls and as a coach and oh, let him go play for fun and you don't give him that option, I don't like that. I don't like that. So I think teaching technique to everybody is important. You don't know what's out there. You don't know
that's
who's,
right.
who's going to spark. Yeah. No, who's going to get that spark and you don't know who they're going to be. You don't know how it's going to change their life. You know, for Olinus, he got to go to college with that.
Yeah, I understand.
You know, otherwise he would have just been another guy that sprays balls. I'll never make it. You know?
Yeah, really. So. Considering how much experience you have from junior tennis, both in Sweden and international, do you feel like we in Sweden have like, how would you say, do you cooperate a lot with the association, for example? Do they like use your knowledge, if I'm allowed to say so?
No, I mean, look, I'm a private. It's a private company.
Yeah.
And Swedish Tennis Federation, Norwegian Tennis Federation, Danish Tennis Federations are public.
Yeah.
Sometimes those don't mix.
Okay. But they can mix.
They could. They could. But in this instance, I think my lack of filter. I say what I want when I want to say it. That's my age talking, and it's my what I think is some pretty good experience. Not everybody appreciates hearing, and that's fine. And I'm good with that. I work for my kids.
Yeah.
I work for the players. Yeah. That's where all of my energy goes. Yeah. Not to please anybody. Do we tolerate each other? Sure. I'm sure they appreciate what's going on. You know, we take out a lot of kids. The federations don't have to pay for that. They can still get a lot of international experience with us, with Good to Great, you know, with Kunglia, with their group going on internationally. So, and Swedish tennis benefits from that hugely. You know,
don't you think we could benefit even more from what you know? It's not your fault. It's like everybody else's maybe mistake.
Oh, no, I don't know. It might be my fault, actually.
Because of, or how?
Well, you know, you know, maybe I could learn to say no in 5 minutes instead of just no. Maybe.
See what more I mean? The Swedish way.
I'm not, but you know, you know, at the end of the day, everybody has ways to communicate. I'm not going to change mine for anybody. I've done okay like this. So could I be more diplomatic and probably be involved more? Probably so, but I don't really know how, and I don't want to take the energy to do that. I'm I like saying what I need to say.
Mm.
I'm a big team guy. Mm. I love teams.
Mm.
Yeah, and I'd like to always try to be part of the team.
Mm.
But if it isn't to be, I'm not going to be crying over it.
Mm.
It's okay. Could they learn some things? Sure. Could I learn some things from them? Absolutely. I'll steal from anybody. I'll steal from you. In fact, I think I stole one of your drills in Elfsborg.
Yeah.
So we can all learn from each other.
Okay.
But you know, I think at this late stage, when I'm kind of pulling back now, yeah, maybe I'll get a call.
Yeah.
You never know.
We'll see.
Yeah.
But do you feel like appreciated in Swedish tennis?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't live for appreciation. That can be deceptive. You know, if you start living for people's okays and for other people's appreciation, I think you're going to be up and down all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think life is supposed to be that way.
Okay. But it's always nice to feel like, okay,
it's nice that it happens, but I know the players in EuroLeague appreciate it. I know a lot of people have come to me or written, the parents have written to say, you know, nobody saw the potential in Johnny and you know, you picked him out and man, he's really happy. Or, you know, they were, this one was passed over for this but he's able to come to EuroLeague and participate and make new friends. Cause that's really a big part of EuroLeague too. Is getting together with different people, different areas of Sweden, Norway, Denmark, making friends.
Mm.
Yeah. Hopefully for life. Mm. And again, trying to find a way to make them stay in the game, keep them inspired, keep them coming back, keep them excited.
Mm.
And this is a kind of a boost.
Mm.
Yeah. For them to come to these camps, which again are all geared to get ready for tours.
Yeah,
yeah,
I understand.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever considered starting an academy for real? Like, you know, facility and practice place? No?
Heavens, no.
Why not?
No, I like this. No.
Because that would, like, from outside, it kind of looks like this next step or...
No, look, here's again, here's the old-fashioned part. I think kids should be, you know, by and large, stay with their families.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and go to a regular school, you know, as much as long as possible.
Okay.
I know some of the guys are doing distance now.
Mm-hmm.
They're 03s or 02s, and that's fine. They're older now. Mm-hmm. They've had that experience. But I'm just old fashioned enough to think they should be with moms and dads.
Mm-hmm.
They should be at school with regular people, you know, not just tennis people.
Mm.
I love seeing them for 3 days and I love seeing them go, you know, and you know, getting them excited about this. And I really enjoy working with the clubs. I've never gotten a negative mail from a club say, you did this wrong. Or what are you doing to my kid? Or, you know, what does that grip change and all that? Because we don't do that. You know, Prime, like I said, is a little bit different program I've created a year and a half ago. That's a little bit different. That's a hybrid program that only deals with me. But the project that 120 players are in right now, those players are we're meant to give them a boost, get them back home, share some drills with your coaches if they want to do that. We're open to, you know, somebody emailing me, can we talk about Johnny's forehand, backhand or whatever, or what drill was this? I love doing that. I love working with coaches who want to learn. And, you know, my next question to them would be, hey, if I go to your place, I want to see your drills because I'd like to steal a few. You know, I need a few more new ones.
Yeah, I understand.
Yeah. Okay. But no, I mean, full-time academy, even if I was younger, you know, I'm in, you know, middle 60s now. I would never do it because of the there's huge obligations to buildings and to things breaking down and everything else. 24/7 this, 24/7 that.
Yeah.
I'm not there.
You don't want to spend time on it.
No. And but the whole philosophy was of EuroLeague when we started was not to replace the club.
Mm.
It was to make the club look bigger by being able to send the kids out to different tournaments. Yeah,
okay.
And yet still have the club coaches stay there because they've got families.
Mm.
They can't go out. You know, they can't travel. They're raising a family. Of course they can't. Or maybe small clubs have a couple of talented players, two, three courts, and that coach is needed at that club. He can't go out. Well, come on over. This is what your elite was about at the beginning.
I understand.
Yeah, it was to help complement the coaches. And we have a good niche here. Mm. Yeah, so we don't work on the technical areas in the project. We work a lot on the mind. We work a lot on training the tactical areas, and we work a lot on decision making on and off the court.
And I know you have talked about like what you're passionate about and what motivates you, but how much is money a motivation for you, and how much have that been a motivation for you?
Oh, that's a really good question. A lot of people think I'm making a lot of money.
Don't you?
Listen.
I got you.
Yeah. No, it's not as much as you think. But look, here's the deal. If I think I told you at the beginning of this interview, it's a little embarrassing to get paid for something that you love doing and you would do for free anyway. Yeah. And there's a lot of things I do for free. You have to give back to the game. You've got to give back. You've got to give scholarships. I think we gave out over 100,000 crowns last year. Mm-hmm. In scholarships, but we, you know, this is probably the first time I've ever mentioned it on air here, because it's nobody's business what I do, you know, and who I give that to. You know, we don't put it on the internet or whatever. So, you know, at the end of the day, the money, you know, I don't really have any bills like other people do. I'm divorced now and the kids are grown. So I don't have that kind of expense. Money was never the motivation. We started, I think, 15 years ago, 500 crowns for a week, whole 3-day camp. Remember that? The 500
club?
Yeah. It's called the Dave's 500 Club. It didn't even have a name anymore. It didn't have a name yet. Dave's 500 crowns for the whole weekend. Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah. And it's more now, obviously, because costs are more. And you know, we have coaches and it's different. You know, I used to be myself with 10 kids. Yeah. And so, you know,
it's grown. Yeah.
Yeah. It's grown. And the quality is probably higher, but I think we did a pretty good job back then. No, I mean, tennis has been great to me. Yeah. There's no doubt. But also, just like, I tell the kids, and when we listen to the Arnold Schwarzenegger 6 rules of success, you got to get back, you give back. And if you don't, that's a shame. And, you know, one of the kids, I have to tell you, Andre Goranson, he's one of the ones who gives back.
Okay.
You know, he'll come to a summer camp, train, you know, hit with the kids and say hi and things like that anytime he can. He couldn't this year, but the year before, he come to a camp. Giving back is really important. So that's
what you're trying to do.
That's what I try to do. Yeah.
Okay. And in your eyes, since like you started EuroElite and this journey, how important do you think EuroElite have been for Swedish tennis over the last 20 years?
Let's put it another way. If we wouldn't have been here for these last 20 years, probably over 1,000 kids wouldn't have gone out on the tour on their own. Probably. Now, maybe somebody else would have come up. Maybe something
you don't know that.
We don't know. But I do know that we're, you know, when we take out over 150 kids a year on the tours, and we've done that consistently for the last 15 years, you know, it adds up quick. I mean, you were in Slovenia. We had 30 kids there every year.
Yeah.
You know, Jufa Cup, we usually have 30 kids there every year. We make that a camp and a tour. We call it a tourney camp. So we've taken out, you know, hundreds and hundreds of kids. And that's great for Swedish tennis. That's great for Norwegian and Danish tennis as well. So, you know, from the base numbers alone, I think it's been a great thing for Swedish tennis. And the fact of the matter is that when the parents pay, it's no burden on the federation, and those kids get that experience of getting out. Yeah.
All right, Dave, we're into the last segment. Do you have any role model you have looked up to over the years? Or maybe in the beginning? I don't know.
Dennis Ralston.
Oh yeah, you named him before, I think. Yeah,
He coached at SMU, played top level tennis himself, won the U.S. Open. Very good in doubles. Coached Chrissy Everett all of her career, and he took me under his wing.
Okay.
Any specific you think you like brought from him or learned from him?
Well, you know, the very, very small areas of technique training.
Okay.
You know, he was a very technical guy.
Mm.
And it's one of these things where when you're a coach, when you're beginning a new coach, a lot of people just hang the shingle out and say, I'm a coach now.
Mm.
And they assume that you know technique. Dennis, I mean, you had to be there and feed exactly right. You have to listen to him. And I wanted to listen to him because he was so good at what he did.
Yeah.
We didn't spend as much time together as we really wanted to, but Dennis Ralston, for sure. I mean, he was an incredible coach.
Okay.
Yeah.
Movie or book you have been inspired by?
A movie or a book?
That you can recommend, I guess.
That I can recommend. Yeah. Tennis one.
Yeah, whatever you like.
Okay. Well, that's a, Coaching Tennis by Chuck Creasy.
Okay.
Yeah. It's a very, Chuck was a very tough coach.
Uh-huh.
And the book, I don't know if it's even in print.
Okay.
But it's a very good one. And then another one, if you don't mind.
Yeah, sure.
Alistair Hyman wrote book about momentum. And it's not very often that you get books about momentum. It's not very thick. It's very, very thin book, but it was an incredible, incredible book about the secrets of momentum.
Okay.
So those two are really, really important because momentum is a huge part of the game that's lost. How to get it, how to keep it.
Okay.
If you've lost it, how to get it back.
Okay.
Momentum is especially at the higher levels. Is a part of the game that I think has been underrated.
You know where we can find it?
You just go on Amazon. It's still there. He's from Great Britain.
Okay.
And cool. I can't really recall the exact title.
No, okay.
But if you put Momentum and Alistair Hyman on there, then you'll get it.
Nice.
Yeah.
Favorite country?
Oh, boy, Mexico is one.
Yeah.
I mean,
you have a place there.
Not only that. I like the food. I like the people. I like the weather. But they've had, you know, I used to go to the grade A there all the time in Mexico City.
Yeah.
And then the grade one in the Yucatan.
Mm.
And that's really what propelled me to get my place in Acapulco there. So
okay.
I would say Mexico. and second would be Czech Republic.
All right. Yeah. It's two different countries.
Totally different. Yeah. But Czech Republic is an hour from here.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's easy to pop over and relax.
What would you say is the last thing you changed your mind about?
Wow, that's a good question. I'll tell you now.
Yeah.
Forehands. Interesting how you load your leg.
Okay.
On when you're hitting a forehand, you load your right leg and then drive up on the leg. And I really don't like it much when that left leg lifts up.
Okay.
I know it's going to happen.
Yeah.
I know it could happen naturally. But I like to load the right leg and then bring that right leg through, bring it along with the arm and the shoulder. And I was watching a lot of the pros, and then I search on the internet for things like this because I have no life. Except this.
Searching for the right leg.
Because I'm looking, I'm looking to see if I can find some information about why it's, of course, you need to load your back leg, line it up, load it, and use that leg. But why it's not good to lift the left leg. And I couldn't really come with a good logical answer there. That left leg's going to go up when you drive from the right leg. But I think there's sometimes when you, I think what I changed my mind on is you maybe shouldn't have to try every single time to drive your back leg also through the ball. So if you load the right leg and you bring the right leg through, which I like to do, then it's not always going to happen. So I kind of changed my mindset on that. I saw a very
interesting.
Yeah, I saw a very good video, and
maybe.
Yeah. So I
okay.
Good answer.
I'm still learning.
Good answer. What's the biggest waste of time in tennis?
100 shot rallies, hitting cones.
Okay. Yeah,
unless you're doing it because you've made a grip change, a technique change, or you have to work on focus. You know, somebody's losing focus a lot and you want to hit the cones. I think that's a big waste of time.
Isn't it good to practice your precision?
This is where it's at. If you're already, now let's assume that you're already a good player. Let's say you're a level grade 3 ITF player.
Mm.
Okay. Grade 2 ITF player. This is where I'm coming from.
Mm.
To just blatantly hit cones and hit 50, 100 balls. Which rally is that really? Come on.
Mm.
The average, according to Craig O'Shaughnessy and the facts, is that the ball is going to be hit 4 times. Mm. 0 to 4 times, about 65% of the time. It's going to be hit 5 to 9 times, somewhere in the 30s, okay, over there. So do you need that, of course, to groove in strokes if you're changing or you lack focus and you need to do that? Yes. Precision, maybe. But it doesn't really simulate match play.
Mm. The ball is not coming back all the time.
Yeah, exactly. And it's not coming back. Here's what's happening, really. I'm sending you a ball, right? A neutral ball, because I want to hit the cone.
Mm.
You're sending me a neutral ball back. But then if I have a ball that's a little bit higher, and that guy sends a weaker ball that's shorter, I should hit the hell out of that ball.
Mm.
That's what I should do. But what am I doing? I'm hitting it back to the cone, neutral, when I should be stepping all over that ball. That's what really should happen. So I'm losing opportunity to learn how to, we call it, I think, flakka, to go for the shot.
Yeah.
And the other guy's losing an opportunity to hit a defensive shot, to learn that part.
Yeah.
So I
Too
many neutral balls. Yeah, and you lose the ability to recognize what ball you should really step in and take.
All right. Yeah. If you could change one rule in tennis, what would that be?
One rule.
Yeah.
Denmark's already done it. International tennis has already done it. Denmark just did it last week. Serve the net, goes in, and you play. Denmark changed.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I wish they would do that here.
Net court should be allowed in.
Net court should be allowed.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's
allowed in every other shot, so why not that?
Yeah. They have tried in some junior tournaments here, I think, but not in all of them.
No.
Obviously.
But I think they're testing it out. I think eventually it'll happen.
What's the latest thing you did for your first time?
Oh dear. Okay. Well, that's too. I'm
something.
Look, I'm 64 years old. There isn't much I haven't done the first time. I think this. Podcast. Yeah,
podcast.
I mean, live. podcast with you. I mean, I don't normally do these things. I think I begged away before.
It's fun, isn't it?
Yeah, it's an interesting exercise. But yeah, I think that has to be it.
We're almost done there. I don't really know this in English, but I want to ask, you have worked for so many years now as a coach, and you said you're 64 now.
Yep.
How have you done to be able to keep the energy up all the years, or keep the speed up?
Oh,
because it's kind of you. I mean, to not break down.
Number one, you gotta just love what you do.
Yeah,
you gotta keep fresh. And you know, if the people who know me and been around me a long time know that, you know, I'm pretty tough on the court.
Mm.
Yeah. I expect you to work hard, but I love humor.
Yeah.
I love to laugh. I love to crack a joke.
Yeah.
You know, and even if I have to get on you, I have to put the shoe in the old rear end. we're still fine after that. I'll crack a joke 2 minutes later because maybe it's something that I didn't like that you did, but I like who you are.
Mm.
Yeah. And if you keep making the same mistake over and over again, it's gonna irritate me.
Mm.
So that's one of the things that's the fun part that keeps me young is the humor, is it being around young people.
Mm.
But I think the biggest thing is just like what I did the other day, and I had to change my mind on a little bit more.
Mm.
I research. I look at things. Mm. I'm curious.
Mm.
I'm just not going to say, oh, I have a large tennis academy and this grew and this grew. I'm not satisfied with that.
Yeah. No. You feel like you're improving and learning new things all the time.
I so want that to keeps improve. You going. Yeah, yeah. I want to improve and learn all the time. Yeah. And then I want to share it.
Yeah.
So if you just keep it to yourself, that's no fun.
No.
It's cool. You know, when I'm on the tour, especially I was with a German coach during January, we were just sitting down and talking about old times and then sharing drills.
Yeah.
And I had a paper, he had a paper, and we just shared 5 or 6 drills. It's so fun.
That's great. Huh?
Yeah, thank you.
Dave, it's been a pleasure talking to you.
You too.
Thank you for taking your time.
You're welcome.
Dave, what a character. But regardless if you think he's too straightforward sometimes or not, in my eyes, no one can take away what he has been doing for Swedish and Scandinavian tennis over the last 20 years. Like he said, the amount of players he have given memories for life, both at camps and tours, that's incredible. And in my eyes, something worth giving more credit to than at least Swedish tennis have done recently. I have always said that I like the values and the tactical stuff both Dave and the team is teaching at EuroElite. I think that's the kind of things the club environments is lacking, maybe both time and possibilities to do enough on a daily basis. And I think it's great that there's a place and an organization that does that. In the best of the world, of course, the daily coaches at the home club could do that as well. But I'm not sure that that's how things works out nowadays. For more information about EuroElite, please visit EuroElite.info. For more information about Tennis Magazinet, please visit tennismagasinet.se or send an email to me at linus.eriksson@tennismagasinet.se. Don't forget to follow me on Instagram, linus_se_eriksson. There you can see Dave answer my first 5 fast questions. Who doesn't want to hear which tennis federation in Scandinavia he prefers? For example. Thanks for listening, and let's hear from you soon again.